Russian President Vladimir Putin repeats his call for security guarantees from the West as he blames the U.S.-led NATO for escalating tensions over Ukraine. Iran's President Raisi says a principled policy of his country is to support the stability and sovereignty of neighboring Iraq. Palestinians hold a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli soldiers in Ramallah on Wednesday. I'm Behrouz Najaf. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin stressing that the West should give security guarantees to his country as tensions go on over Ukraine.
Our reactions will depend not on the negotiation process, but on the unconditional security of Russia. We've made it clear and explicit that further NATO movement is where it's unacceptable. What's unclear? Is it us who places the missiles near the USA borders? No, it was the USA who came with its missiles to our house. They're on the doorstep of our house. You're demanding some guarantees from me. It is you who must give us the guarantees. You. Immediately. Now.
Now, Putin says Russia's security is threatened by Ukraine's growing ties with the Western military alliance. He says that NATO has cheated Russia with five waves of expansion since the Cold War. The U.S. and NATO accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow strongly denies that and plans talks with the U.S. and NATO early next year in order to defuse the tensions. In the press briefing, the Russian president also spoke about a gas crisis in Europe. He said it's unfair to blame Moscow for the crisis, as the Russian company Gazprom is meeting its obligations.
They lie all the time. They mix everything up. Gazprom supplies all the requisite gas volumes under current contracts. And not only that, but it's also increasing the volume by 12%, I guess, or around 20% of supplies far abroad and to Europe.
Well, Putin says that he suspects some Russian gas pipe to Germany was ultimately being resold to Ukraine. He added that Europe is stuck on long-term contracts and has created its own gas problems. The continent is grappling with record-breaking natural gas prices and a strong winter demand. Some analysts blame the spike on simmering tensions with Russia. That's the key supplier. Journalist and political commentator Fred Ware believes that the West is recognizing that it has pushed NATO's eastward expansion too far and is seeking dialogue with Moscow.
There is a war of words going on right now. You need to look past the rhetoric, the purple clouds of who's threatening whom, and see that they have agreed to talk. And the mood, both in the United States and in NATO, I think is much more congenial than it was in years past. I think everybody recognizes that they pushed NATO expansion too far. They have a case of indigestion, I mean, of a geostrategic nature. And also they realize that Russia has rebounded. It's not the Russia of the 1990s anymore. It's a much stronger, more unified, and economically resilient place. It's got its deep security concerns. It's always had them. It isn't something new. It has never liked NATO expansion. The thought of Ukraine joining NATO has always made Russians see its thoughts before their eyes. It's just that now a strong Russia is drawing a line. And it also may have something to do with the fact that the United States, in particular, has shown itself to be strategically incoherent and incapable.
Now, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi tells the Iraqi foreign minister that a principal policy of Iran is to support the stability and the sovereignty of Iraq. Raisi was speaking with Fuad Hussein here in Tehran. He said that Iran views insecurity in neighboring Iraq as insecurity on Iranian soil. He also hailed the resistance of the Iraqi people and said that's the main reason making American forces leave the Arab country. The president said that once the U.S. enters a country, it does not leave unless it faces popular resistance. Prime of an Iranian foreign minister is saying that his country, in a serious manner, continue talks with the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Iran will do that until negotiations result in a good agreement.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. On the whole, we did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France. In the latest round of talks, the three European countries practically presented no new initiatives.
The official also said that Tehran rejects this approach, that the other parties offer one concession to get several in turn. Tehran, the remaining JCPOA members, have held seven rounds of talks in Vienna this year to resolve outstanding issues over the 2015 deal. Those issues began after the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018, reinstating sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its commitments a year later. Iran says it will fully meet its obligations only after the U.S. removes the sanctions. Vienna will host a new round of negotiations by the JCPOA members next week. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli fire a day before. A mourning procession was held in Ramallah in the Akbar West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammed Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is critical of new Israeli rules that give soldiers more freedom to use deadly force. It says the rules are further proof of the Israeli military leaders' criminal behavior and terrorist policies that encourage the deliberate killing of innocent people. Israel has amended its open fire rules to allow soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones, even when they don't pose an imminent threat. From Ramallah, I'm joined by Mustafa Bakuti, who is with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. Good to have you with us, sir. So we've been watching this, especially in the past weeks, that things are happening and more Palestinians are being killed. And as you just heard in the intro, there is this modification in the rule. They simply open fire on Palestinians who even do not pose any threat to Israeli soldiers. Why is this happening?
These are not isolated incidents. These are part of a strategy that the Israeli government is following. And it aims at suppressing any kind of Palestinian resistance or rejection of the Israeli plans to annex the West Bank. What is happening is that the Israeli army has decided to legalize committing war crimes against Palestinians, including shooting Palestinians even when they are representing no threat to anybody. And that the translation of that was the assassination of this young man who was Mohammed Abbas, who was killed in Ramallah. But before that, they shot the car of another Palestinian and they burned him alive inside that car. And these are incidents that keep repeating. In my opinion, what is happening is very dangerous because there is a serious shift in the Israeli establishment, not only to the right, but actually towards fascist behavior. And this shift is very much encouraged and supported and promoted by no less than 750,000 illegal settlers who are residing now in the West Bank and accelerating their attacks on the Palestinian people.
Mr. Bakuti, would these killings kind of stop the Palestinians from pursuing their cause?
Absolutely not. On the contrary, these acts practically provoke more Palestinian reaction, and it convinces every Palestinian that there is no security here for any Palestinian under occupation. It convinces every Palestinian that relying on any possible negotiations with Israel is useless, since this Israeli government is even rejecting any form or act of political discussion, and they declare every day that they are not going to allow a Palestinian statehood, they are not going to allow Palestinian freedom, and they insist on their process of settlement expansion and annexation. Practically, these acts convince Palestinians more than ever before that there is no use of building hopes on negotiations and that they should unify themselves together in one struggle against occupation to remove not only the occupation, but the whole system of apartheid and racial discrimination that is practiced against the Palestinian people.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts and comments, Mossal Barghouti from Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah. Saudi warplanes have conducted fresh airstrikes in Yemen, this time targeting Hodeidah province. At least a civilian got killed and another one injured in the latest attack. Saudi Arabia has stepped up its air raids on Yemen recently, pounding different locations there. The targets include the international airport and the capital Sana'a. Riyadh bombed the facility several times on Monday, bringing aid flights to a halt. Yemenis are dependent on aid supplies to survive, and that's because their country is under a land, sea, and air blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia as part of its aggression against their country. Now, that's why the World Food Program says it will reduce the food rations of 8 million Yemenis. It's suffering from a shortage of funds, and that's why the WFP already warned that the current level of hunger in Yemen is unprecedented and is causing severe hardship for millions of people there.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme's done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operating expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Let's now turn to Afghanistan, where a bomb attack has rocked the capital city. The blast took place close to the gate of passport office in Kabul. Initial reports indicating it was a car bomb. The government saying that a suicide bomber has been killed and several people got injured. No group has claimed responsibility. In recent weeks, there have been a series of bombings and terrorist attacks across the country. They were mostly claimed by the Daesh terrorist group that's engaged in a fierce power rivalry with the Taliban. Meantime, the number of children in Afghanistan not getting enough to eat is on the rise. Health facilities in the country are overflowing with malnourished children. And UNICEF is warning time is running out to save Afghan children. Our correspondent has more from Kabul.
We are visiting Afghanistan's largest children's hospital in Kabul. These days, the hospital is receiving malnourished babies more than any time before. Doctors here say malnutrition has increased since the poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan, adding the hospital lacks beds and medicines.
The patients in our malnutrition wards have recently increased. There aren't enough rooms for them. Sometimes we have to place more than one patient on an individual bed. If the ongoing shortage of food and nutrition continues, more and more children will face malnutrition.
World countries should help Afghan malnourished mothers and children. It's obvious to all what's going on in Afghanistan. Our breadwinners are jobless as winter bites. Children and mothers are being malnourished as food is not brought to table.
According to UNICEF, 3.2 million children under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year. Authorities say world countries should not leave Afghan children alone.
Definitely, our hospital has been suffering from bad impacts of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has seized what belongs to Afghan innocent people, and it is a cruel attempt. I demand the international community to send their humanitarian aid to Afghan people today, as they used to help our nation under the previous government.
Following the Taliban took over of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off, and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S.
The war may be over in Afghanistan, but the nation now is struggling with an economic crisis. Half of the population of Afghanistan is facing acute hunger, and over 1 million Afghan children are at risk of dying. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
900 News, France will launch a lawsuit against Britain to settle a lingering dispute over post-Brexit fishing rights. The French Europe Minister says that the high-profile meeting with EU representatives will take place in early January, and then a suit will be filed with a special tribunal. Paris and London have been at loggerheads for months over how many licenses the French fishermen are entitled to. France accuses Britain of holding back on licenses. Last week, Britain agreed to issue an additional 23 licenses for French boats, but France believes it's entitled to around 80 more. Under a post-Brexit deal, EU fishermen can continue to work in British waters if they can prove they used to fish there. Russia is not the third country in the world to pass the grim milestone of 600,000 COVID deaths after the U.S. and Brazil. There have been more than 1,000 new deaths in the past day. Officials, however, saying that the Omicron variant has had little impact so far, with only several dozen cases detected across the nation in the past week. The new variant is being blamed for a COVID surge across many countries. In the U.S., it's now the dominant strain. Europe is again turning into a hotspot with its latest record high infections. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, said on Monday, 20th of December, her investigation of Donald Trump's business affairs would continue undeterred, despite Trump suing to stop it on grounds of political bias, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, New York Attorney General vows Trump investigation will proceed undeterred. Attorney General Letitia James said on Monday, 20th of December, her investigation of Donald Trump's business affairs would continue undeterred, despite Donald Trump suing to stop it on grounds of political bias, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The New York Times first reported Trump's lawsuit filed in federal court in Syracuse, New York. It alleges that Letitia James, a Democrat, is guided solely by political animus and a desire to harass, intimidate, and retaliate against a private citizen who she views as a political opponent. Letitia James is investigating whether the Trump Organization manipulated valuations of its real estate properties. In one such instance, as Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, The Guardian reported on different valuations of a golf club outside of New York City. The headline, "How Trump's $50 million golf club became $1.4 million when it came time to pay tax." The Washington Post and other media outlets have also reported similar alleged practices at other Trump properties. Last year, investigators working for Letitia James interviewed Eric Trump, one of former president's sons and a Trump Organization executive. Letitia James went to court to enforce a subpoena, and a judge forced the younger Trump to testify after his lawyers canceled the deposition. In an investigation that could only result in civil charges, Letitia James recently said she would seek to question Donald Trump under oath. It is rare for law enforcement agencies to issue a civil subpoena for testimony from a person also the subject of a related criminal investigation, partly because the person could simply cite their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. It is unlikely that Trump's lawyers would allow him to be deposed unless they were sure his testimony could not be used against him in a criminal case. Donald Trump's business and tax affairs are also the subject of a criminal investigation run by the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, which has been in progress for more than 3 years. Letitia James joined that investigation in May of this year. The Manhattan case includes a focus on whether the Trump Organization overstated the value of some real estate assets to obtain loans and tax benefits. In their lawsuit against Letitia James, who recently announced a run for governor of New York before stepping back, Trump and the Trump Organization claimed the Attorney General has violated their rights under the U.S. Constitution by pursuing a politically motivated investigation. Donald Trump and the company pointed to public statements that Letitia James made before she was elected as Attorney General. The lawsuit also made a plainly political play of its own, echoing Trump's language in office and on the campaign trail when it said, "Rather than diligently prosecuting actual crimes in the state of New York, which are steadily on the rise, James has instead allocated precious taxpayer resources towards a frivolous witch hunt." Donald Trump and the Trump Organization are seeking a court order barring the investigation from going forward. In a statement, Trump's attorney, Alina Haber, said, "By filing this lawsuit, we intend to not only hold her accountable for her blatant constitutional violations, but to stop her bitter crusade to punish her political opponent in its tracks." In her own statement, Letitia James said, "The Trump Organization has continually sought to delay our investigation into its business dealings, and now Donald Trump and his namesake company have filed a lawsuit as an attempted collateral attack on that investigation." To be clear, neither Donald Trump nor the Trump Organization get to dictate if and where they will answer for their actions. Our investigation will continue undeterred, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, also noted that in August of 2020, she filed a motion to compel the Trump Organization to provide documents and testimony from multiple witnesses regarding several specific Trump Organization properties and transactions. Since then, the court has ruled in Attorney General James's favor multiple times. Last month, Donald Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, who served a three-year sentence for offenses including campaign finance violations relating to a payoff to Stormy Daniels, who claims an affair with Donald Trump, was asked about the prospect of Trump being indicted in the criminal investigation in Manhattan. Michael Cohen said he was confident that prosecutors could indict Donald Trump tomorrow if they really wanted to, and they could be successful. Asked if he was confident, "You did help Donald Trump commit crimes," Michael Cohen told NBC. "I can assure you that Donald Trump is guilty of his own crimes. Was I involved in much of the inflation and deflation of his assets? The answer to that question is yes." In July, the longtime Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg pleaded not guilty to criminal charges in what a prosecutor in Cyrus Vance's office called a sweeping and audacious 15-year tax fraud.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
We've been discussing the matter of the emotional connection with Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and the importance of it, what it is, and how to improve that, how to increase that relationship. If we don't understand that, the way we're going to be dealing with this relationship is going to be different compared to when we know what her relationship is, what her part is, what does she do, what type of involvement does she have. When things are going well, when things are, you know, the way we like them to be, and we're doing our tawassul, and we're doing our Fatimiyya, and we're doing our Muharram, and we're doing everything that we do regularly, we keep saying, oh yeah, alhamdulillah, this, the blessings I have are from Fatima al-Zahra, the blessings I have are from Amir al-Mu'mineen, the blessings I have are from Imam al-Hussein. These are the things we say. But then when we hit difficulty, and then we plead to them, and we keep asking, if it goes away fast, again we say, look, Imam al-Hussein is true, Fatima al-Zahra, but if it starts taking longer, it starts taking longer and longer and longer and longer, and I don't see what I want from them. I'm pleading to them. There's something specific I want, a hardship I'm dealing with that I want removed, a certain thing I don't have that I want them to give me, and it's not coming my way. And it's taking longer and longer and longer and longer, and it's not happening. What do we start feeling? We start thinking, is there really someone there? Are we actually in a relationship with someone? Are we actually being heard? Do they care? These are all thoughts that come to our mind. Those who are certain that they are there, the Ahlul Bayt are there, God's angels are there, God above all is there. Those who are sure of that, then they can't convince themselves otherwise. Alhamdulillah, they're strong enough believers to know that, you know, that's definitely not the case that I could say they're not there. I know for a fact that they're there, no matter what happens. But then we start thinking of our deficiencies, the problems we have, and we start saying, well, you know, I don't deserve anything. And so we start resolving it that way. This is why it's not happening. I don't deserve. Again, although it's correct that I don't deserve, that's definitely true. I don't deserve. But that's not the reason why I'm not seeing what I'm asking for. That's not the reason. That's not the reason. If we analyze me not receiving something as me not being worthy of it, without realizing, because if we did, we would never do this, we'd never say this, we're saying that I don't deserve and they don't want to give. Because I don't deserve has always been the case. Even when they gave, I didn't deserve. It's not like I deserve anything that I've been given. I deserve nothing, absolutely nothing. Whatever is given is out of their generosity. So if I conclude that if I'm not receiving something, it's because they're not giving, because I never deserve. It's not like now I don't deserve. I didn't deserve anything. So if I'm saying the reason why they're not giving is me not deserving, and then convincing myself that, okay, this is not coming my way. Well, see, when I'm saying it's not coming my way, I'm concluding that they, because I didn't deserve, they didn't give. And there's where the problem is. We start to think of the relationship in a different way. As I said, that's the wrong thought. And then a lot of times it's just not really thinking or really looking at their part in this relationship. So what is it? And how do we explain all of this? What it is that the relationship is actually that they initiate, or in this case, she initiates the relationship with us. If we have love for her, it's because she initiated that. She gave us that. If we remember her, think of her, ask her for help, develop that relationship, is because she has initiated that every single time. I think I mentioned this. I want to talk a little deeper about this, but right now you're just hearing it from some nobody like myself. Okay, well, someone that has words that can be respected as the words of an authority, a scholar, a marja, a leader, Ayatollah Khamenei said that when we saw in the war that Fatima al-Zahra was being mentioned, tawassul to her, and the more we looked, he said, we were very involved in the war, and we knew who was propagating what. We knew the people that were being sent for propagational purposes to strengthen the iman of the people. We knew the ulama that used to go to the battle fronts and speak to. We didn't see any visible source that is pumping this idea into the mu'mineen in the battlefields. That their tawassulat, the writings, they used to write things on the back of their shirts. Their love for Fatima al-Zahra, that we're going to seek revenge for the slap that was laid on the face of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayhi. We are the children of Fatima al-Zahra. All these different elements of tawassul, remembrance, reminders of Fatimah al-Zahra. He said, we knew who's involved and there was no visible source for this. And this is a clearer indication, he says. Our point is, every time, even if you're hearing it from me, who the heck am I? If you're hearing it from any speaker and you're being reminded, that speaker is being reminded of this relationship, Fatimah al-Zahra is reminding him or her, whoever it is. It's her initiating this. She is the one who starts it. She's the one that makes it happen. She's the one that is more involved in that relationship. He says, Ayatollah Khamenei says, in that context, it was more visible that it's nothing external, nothing material, none of these people that are here, all of them are being influenced by something unseen. What? Fatimah al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, herself. This is how the relationship is. She's more interested in me going to her and crying for her to get closer to Allah. She's the path to Allah. She sees herself as nothing. She sees that whatever she has, she's an amah of Allah, amatullah, a slave. Abd is the Arabic word for a male slave. Emma is the word for female. If you've been in the prayers for the amwat, for the deceased, that you will hear that. Abduk wabnu abdik. Amatuk wabnu abdik wabnu, or bintu abdik bintu amatik. She is someone that sees nothing. The reality is she has nothing except for what Allah. She's a manifestation of divine mercy. That's who she is. Looking at her as a person, she is more interested in us remembering her with Ali ibn Abi Talib, remembering her behind the door, remembering her in the street in Medina, beating our chest for her, asking her for assistance, speaking to her, telling her of our troubles, of our issues, and our need for assistance from her, in order for her to do her job, her responsibility to Allah, which is to get us closer to Him.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء
إنه سلمي إلى العلياء فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
As former U.S. President Donald Trump's loyalists laid siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Sam Levine and David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republicans Are Shamelessly Working to Subvert Democracy. Are Democrats paying attention? As the first anniversary of the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol approaches, there is no shortage of warnings about the danger of a repeat by Republicans. But even as former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists lay siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. Tony Evers, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, said, "At the state level, we're raising hell about it, but the Democrats on the national level are talking about Build Back Better, the infrastructure bill, and lots of other things." He added, "When we think about voting rights and democracy, I would hope we would hear a little bit more about that from the national level." Hopes that the attack on the Capitol would break the fever of Trumpism in the Republican Party were soon dashed. All but a handful of its members in Congress voted against the 9/11-style commission to investigate the riot, and many at national level have downplayed it, rallying to the former president's defense. But it is an attritional battle playing out state by state, county by county, and precinct by precinct that could pose the biggest menace to the next election in 2024, a potential rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. An avalanche of voter suppression laws is being pushed through in Republican-led states, from Arizona to Florida, from Georgia to New Hampshire. Gerrymandered maps are being drawn up to form districts where demographics favor Republican candidates. Backers of Donald Trump's big lie of a stolen election are running to be the Secretary of State in many places, a position from which they would serve as the chief election official in their state. Donald Trump has endorsed such candidates in Michigan, in Arizona, in Georgia, and in Nevada, all crucial swing states. All-out assault suggests that Donald Trump and his allies learned lessons from their failed attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election, identifying weak points in the system and laying the groundwork for a different outcome next time. Dean Phillips, a Democratic congressman from Minnesota, said, "It looks like Plan B is populating state-elected offices with believers of the big lie and morally corrupt candidates. We should all be concerned about that, and, by the way, not just Democrats, but everybody should be concerned." Yet, despite waves of media coverage, recently including The Atlantic magazine and The Guardian and New York Times newspapers, Democrats face the challenge of getting their voters to care. Many are confronting inflation, crime, and other priorities, and may assume that, having defeated Donald Trump last year, they can stop paying attention. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, says, "It's still very difficult to imagine the severity and depth of what Donald Trump tried to pull off. It's hard sometimes to recognize something when it's new. For the president of the United States to try and stage a coup is unprecedented. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around it." Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State described Donald Trump as a clear and present danger who is trying to remove the impediments that rescued democracy last time. state governors are not only the ones sounding the alarm bells, but about the dangers of complacency or assuming that normal services has resumed. Jenna Griswold, a Colorado Democrat seeking re-election, is chair of the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, which focuses on electing Democrats to those positions. She said, "While there's been a surge of attention from activists and donors to those races, it is not enough." She added, "I think one of the issues happening is that because this is the United States, the idea that our most fundamental freedom of living in a democracy is under attack is hard to really grasp." She added, "It's important that we keep leaning in because the folks on the other side are definitely leaning in." In Michigan, one of the leading candidates in the Republican field is Christina Camaro, who has spread lies about 6th of January and the election. She's seeking to oust Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat who became one of the most high-profile secretaries of state in 2020, when she took steps to make it easier to vote by mail in her state. Like Jenna Griswold, Jocelyn Benson, who describes herself as avowedly not a partisan, said she noticed increased interest from voters and independent donors, but not from the National Democratic Party. She said, "We're not seeing the same sense of urgency that perhaps the other side has shown in investing in these offices." She added, "With the exception of the vice president, who's been enormously supportive and gets the importance of these offices from a voting rights standpoint, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders that what we experienced in 2018, which wasn't insignificant." Acolytes of the so-called Stop the Steal movement are drilling down even deeper, targeting local election oversight positions that have traditionally been nonpartisan and little noticed, with only a few hundred votes at stake and candidates often running unopposed. Yet these too could pull at the threads of a democratic fabric. For example, in Pennsylvania, there is concern that election deniers are running for a position called Judge of Elections, a little-known office that plays a huge role in determining how things are run on election day. Scott Seaborg, Pennsylvania State Director of All Voting, is local, a voting advocacy group, said the role is essentially the top position at the precinct polling place on election day. He added, "They could cause huge disruption at the polls based on how the office holder interprets rules around ID and spoiling mail-in ballots." Scott Seaborg agreed that not enough attention has been paid to these local races. He said, "There's no precedent for this, as far as we know, in sort of the modern history of elections. I don't think folks anticipated this. I'm not sure how seriously entities like the Democratic Party are taking this, but they ought to." Similar anxieties emerged recently when the grassroots movement Indivisible ran a focus group with members from Georgia, Indiana, North Carolina, and elsewhere. Ezra Levin, the group's co-founder and co-executive director, said, "They're worried about their governors, they're worried about their secretaries of state, and they're worried even at a more local level about previously nonpartisan or uncontroversial election administration officials being taken over by a well-funded and very focused operation led by people who have embraced the big lie." Ezra Levin added, "These are not positions, especially at the local level, that are getting as much attention, but it's real. We see Steve Bannon, former White House chief of staff and now a right-wing podcast, trying to lead the charge, getting folks to take up the lowest level spots in the election administration ecosystem. It's happening right in front of our own eyes." Ezra Levin, a former congressional staffer, noted that the Democratic Party is not a monolith, but warned that Joe Biden has devoted his political capital, traveling the country to make speeches, holding meetings on Capitol Hill, to causes such as infrastructure, rather than the future of democracy, adding, "This big missing puzzle piece in this entire fight for the last 11 months has been the president." Pressure on the Senate to act intensified these days when 17 governors wrote a joint letter expressing concern over threats to the nation's democracy. Evers of Wisconsin was among them. In a phone interview, he said Democrats in his crucial battleground state are highlighting the full-throated attack on voting rights, but acknowledged that voters have numerous other concerns as well. Evers added, "Everybody's talking about it, but when they go home from the Capitol and they're visiting with people, I'm guessing that the conversation talks about more bread and butter things like, I want my roads fixed, and thank you for reducing taxes." You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom is the best deal one can strike with God.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16th, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28th, 2021.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the remnant of God on earth. First of all, I wish to welcome all of you, dear brothers and sisters, especially the members of the families of the martyrs who are here today, the Honourable Mother of Three Martyrs, and all those involved in conducting this important commemoration ceremony. I truly thank all of you for starting and doing this valuable work. God willing, you will continue and complete it. Please send my sincere regards to the friends who have sent their greetings, including the youth and members of religious gatherings.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The position and role of Zanjan in the history of Iran.
The city of Zanjan has achieved many accomplishments. Throughout history, Zanjan has earned many honors, both in scholarly areas and in action. These accomplishments have been achieved in the religious sciences, jurisprudence, philosophy and mysticism, and in social fields. There have been outstanding personalities with different orientations, but all of them have worked for and in the way of God. There have been personalities such as Akhund Mullah Qurban Ali and the like. Zanjan is truly an outstanding, exemplary city. Regarding the new sciences, our well-known martyr in nuclear sciences, Martyr Shahriari, was one of the honorable sons of the city of Zanjan. Therefore, Zanjan has accomplished many feats. The martyrs from this area, too, are at the top of the list of achievements registered by Zanjan. I will mention a few points about the martyrs, and then I will discuss your work, the move to commemorate martyrs. As for martyrs, martyrs are chosen ones, chosen by God, the Exalted. Martyrs have chosen the right path, and God chose them to reach the destination. The value of martyrs cannot be measured with our material calculations. The martyrs have won in the best deal in the world. O you who have faith, shall I show you a deal that will deliver you from a painful punishment? Have faith in Allah and His Apostle and wage jihad in the way of Allah with your possessions and your persons. The Holy Quran, Surah 61, verses 10 to 11. And it continues to the end. The big winners in this deal are our martyrs. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. What is better than this deal?
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.